I stumbled across the old English proverb, may you live in interesting times.
Impacts on how people feel day to day. A quarter say that they're finding it really hard to get by.
To assert and remind people now that I was not fired by Elon Musk.
The venue is the ICC, and the School Leadership Podcast from LEHT is here to capture the ideas, reflections, and spirit of inspiring leadership. And a reminder that you can dig deeper into the outcomes of the conference by having a look at the July 2023 issue of the LEHT Members Magazine, which is Leadership Focus. And the feature on this year's event is so engaging. The comments from delegates on why they felt it absolutely essential to bring their whole leadership team, and the inherent value in school leaders being able to step back, reflect, and indeed reimagine. You can see it all at neht.org.uk/leadership focus. That's just one word, neht.org.uk/leadership focus. Welcome to Birmingham, then, as we explore what a leader needs to be properly equipped for all the demands and challenges that come their way.
Inspiring leadership, inspiring conversations.
A leading light on workplace culture, resilience, and fortitude. Bruce Daisley, who had the auditorium on its feet for some Icelandic and Viking clapping, talks to the podcast and picks over his key themes. Can schools ever be equipped for teaching resilience in the most effective way? Bruce is with us very soon. Maggie Farrar and Alan Lee's session was on being present. And Maggie is quick to put the doubters right that mindfulness has absolutely nothing to do with crystals or muesli. Hear them talk to me just before they take to the stage. And the NEHT's James Bowen took leave of their very impressive hub just long enough to set the scene for day one of the only event of its kind for UK school leaders.
Yeah, so my name's Mark Burrows and I'm Head of Education at Too Simple. I think when I was at NQT, my first head teacher would always put himself in the firing line for you. So if ever those parents came in and were unhappy, he'd take that flak and always stand up for you and protect you. It wasn't always easy for him, and I think that was admirable.
So I'm Hannah Andrews and I work for Chatty Learning, and my job title is I am an account manager for schools. My current boss has got very high trust in me and trusts me to go ahead and take risks, etc. And an example of that would be that she's left me here today on my own.
Now, as delegates assemble for the welcoming address, let's get the thoughts and observations of James Bowen, who is giving that address in just a few short minutes. And he began by setting out just what inspiring leadership stands for.
It's really quite different to most other conferences, actually. It's quite unique. And I think more than anything, it's about school leaders and often their teams, which again is quite unique, coming with an entire senior leadership team, getting the chance to sort of step away from school for a few days to kind of get new ideas, to have a bit of a space to think, because as a school leader you so often don't have that time and space to do that, to hear from people, some of whom are from the world of education, some of whom aren't, so you start getting these kind of new ideas and new ways of thinking. And as the title says, it's about people feeling inspired, and that's a really important part of it, that people go back to school feeling energized, excited, inspired by what they've heard.
So James, you'll be responsible for the welcome. Can you give us a flavour, a sense of the sorts of things you'll be saying and what you're looking to kind of sum up?
What I'm partly going to do is kind of just reflect and recognise the challenges that school leaders have faced over these last 4 or 5 years. You know, it's just, I mean, I know it's used a lot, but unprecedented times, having to deal with a global pandemic and the challenges that came with that. You know, this generation of school leaders have faced challenges that we just could never, ever have dreamt of. So I will be kind of reflecting, but I don't want to dwell on the negative. So it's a case of kind of let's recognise how tough the last few years have been. But That's why it's so important that this is an opportunity to come and, what I use a quote that John West Burnham, who's a great educational thinker, used to talk about, and he's talked about the need to top up your emotional reservoir as a leader. And I think that's what I'm going to be kind of reminding people, that yes, look, it's been a tough few years, probably more than a few in fact, but actually now is the time to top up your emotional reservoir, to do that refreshing part of it, to recharge your batteries, to come and be inspired. You know, this is the time for that positivity. So that's kind of the theme of what I'll be speaking about.
The restless decade, apparently, we're told.
Yeah, well, I mean, as I say, I talk in the speech about, since 2016, we've had Brexit, a global pandemic, Donald Trump, Boris Johnson, you know, we've got social media, the rise of populism, polarisation. It's, you know, really has been quite a few years to live through. So, yeah, and all of that stuff has an impact on schools. You know, you do feel the effects. You know, the global pandemic is the obvious one, but even other, you know, political developments, those things filter through, and it's our members who are dealing with them.
Yeah. I'm going to play right into your hand here, James, and ask you how, you know, where the NAHT comes in and how the NAHT can, you know, help guide people through these times as you've just depicted them.
So I think more than ever, what we've learned for the last 4 or 5 years is that the importance of that mutual support, that you're not in this alone, and at the heart of being in a union is about that togetherness, that mutual support, that unity, that looking out for each other, being there for each other. So it's not, we shouldn't just think about this as the kind of NAHT staff and what they can do. It's about members supporting each other, and I think that's been so important when you have those really dark times, and I've been there as a head, you know, really challenging moments, knowing that there's someone that you can pick up the phone to and speak with. So important. I think, you know, that's partly where NHT steps in. Of course, we do then have all the, you know, the advice we give, there's the work that our staff do in terms of advice, support, policy development. All of those things are important, but it is at the heart of it that unity and togetherness that really matters, I think.
Inspiring leadership, inspiring conversations.
From NAHT, this is a School Leadership Podcast special, recorded at the ICC in Birmingham for Inspiring Leadership 2023. Well, how do you know if you have enough resilience and sufficient fortitude? I'll be putting that to Bruce Daisley once we've met Maggie Farrar and Alan Lee. Maggie has 4 decades of teaching and leading experience, and amongst a host of incredibly notable achievements, was Director for Leadership Development, Research, and Succession Planning at the National College for School Leadership. Alan is CEO of BEST, a former lead Ofsted inspector, and has successfully delivered school improvement projects across the southeast of England. They shared both the stage and insights on how to be present. Maggie first explains why she came to the conclusion that the notion of being present was being neglected.
I think firstly from my own experience and my own leadership development, and the fact that I had come to the realisation that I was less present, and that was impacting negatively on my leadership. And that also then, of course, brought me to the realisation that that is a neglected part of our current leadership development, which is very outward facing, you know, obviously, understandably. But the inner life of leaders and how we handle that well is very neglected, and, you know, as Alan and I think, it's time to redress. It really is time to redress the balance.
And Alan, did it come from a particular place for you?
Yeah, well, I became quite ill in 2009, and at that time, it wasn't really the job that was the problem. The job was under control. All the sort of Ofsted results was all fine. I just couldn't really switch off, and I kept feeling that perhaps I wasn't good enough or couldn't do the job. And being present to myself and to my family and to other people just gave me a sense of security and nourished me and sustained me, really.
Another word that I know you will allude to and that is mindfulness. So where does that come in, and how would you explain the part it has to play?
That's a really good question, because, you know, mindfulness does conjure up, and Alan and I know this, and we use the word, you know, with caution a little, because it conjures up all sorts of words and images in people's minds. And, you know, as I'll say today at the conference, you know, one head said to me not long ago, Maggie, please don't talk to me about mindfulness. It's all crystals and muesli. You know, that is the image that it does, you know, bring up in some people's minds. But mindfulness is really about being fully attentive to what's going on inside of us, not just our minds, but our bodies, our hearts, and being able to be with that in a way that's non-judgmental, open, not getting entangled by our thoughts or our emotions. So being able to use mindfulness practices, which Alan, you know, will share with us today, that allow us to create some more spaciousness in ourselves, which when we do, we really get in touch with a much deeper inner wisdom, which leaders need. It's there, but often it's been neglected. It may be a little fragile. So for us, that's what mindfulness is, being attentive, aware, open, able to be calm and composed, even in the most difficult of times.
Alan, Maggie there has alluded to some of the bromides, the awful sort of hackneyed terms around mindfulness. Did you have to take a sort of cultural leap? Did you feel that it was an alien world to consider mindfulness?
Not really, because I'm a Catholic, and for me, mindfulness is awareness. And from my Catholic tradition, it's a bit like the Holy Spirit, if you will. Where I've taken the shift is understanding the sort of neuroscience behind it. And so looking at the fact that our thoughts self-arise and that actually we can't control them, but actually just seeing the thought, the seeing actually is the doing. So like at the present moment, I'm nervous about today, and I think, well, that's a good thing that I'm nervous. And by the fact that I can accept that, I can deal with it and it doesn't cause me any trouble. Whereas a few years ago, I'd be thinking, oh my goodness, I'm nervous, I can't do it. I now think, oh my goodness, I'm nervous, I can do this. Thank you very much for being nervous.
Clearly, delegates will go away from your joint session with the wisdom that, you know, you will impart on stage and hopefully learn and put into practice those elements. But what about the wider context? So the way that DFER, Ofsted, schools, parents, even and students, how do you get the message to them and how can that change happen?
Well, you know, Alan, you've developed this path of mindfulness as a gateway to greater presence, as a gateway to being a mindful and compassionate community, even in the midst of all that you've just mentioned.
I think what we need to do is offer an example that is mindful, an example that is compassionate, but also an example that is successful. So of course it does have a well-being dimension, but also has an effectiveness dimension. So, you know, when we see staff not getting distracted, when we see staff performing at very high levels, when we see absentee rates go down, and at the centre of all that is this practice that we notionally call mindfulness, that's when people will start listening. But for me, any sort of leadership development that just focuses on the outside world is obviously missing half of the equation. The greatest journey is the journey inwards.
So just how transformative is it when put into practice by a school? When there's this, I suppose, holistic approach, what kind of anecdotal evidence have you both heard, either together or separately, that it is transformative? What have schools said?
Well, just some examples. You know, one head teacher saying, you know, going into my inner world, that inner journey Alan's just mentioned, is the most daunting thing I've ever done. It is daunting. It's not easy. But as she says, it's given me permission to grow again. It's opened me up. Others, through the practice of kindness and compassion, which sounds woolly and soft, it absolutely is not. It's warrior-like, again, it's tough. Can lead to multiple acts of kindness reverberating around an organisation that builds trust, that changes the culture. And when leaders are more composed, more balanced, they create, and they say this, they create organisations that feel safer, staff feel calmer. You know, you've heard Alan say, you know, although he can feel his nerves, he's not nervous. Well, I'm going to borrow that calm from Alan. And that's what school principals do. If they're calm and composed, others can then borrow it from them. In their words, it's catching. And it makes a difference to a whole range of outcomes.
Alan, just a final thought, so you're both very busy very soon. Would you say it's possible to walk into a school for the first time and know and feel that it's being led by a leader or leaders who are all of these things? You know, is it that palpable, do you think, and have you seen it?
Yes, I have. I think it is. I think you almost the reception area is like the leader's classroom, if you will, and you get a feeling as soon as you walk through the front door. You can see it in the way people treat one another, the quality of relationships. Often the very best faith schools have the same type of feel, but absolutely at the heart there is a sort of understanding that we're all on a journey, and that journey is hard, and that from time to time we'll suffer and we'll struggle, and that's part of being human, and noticing that and supporting each other through that is the journey of life we're all on, and we just touch the joy of the precious nature of the everyday through mindfulness.
Sarah Longshaw, and I'm the Network Education Lead for Science for STEM Learning. I was teaching and we just had an Ofsted inspection which resulted in the previous head departing, and we had one of the super heads came in. I remember introducing myself to him and saying, I'm just a classroom teacher. And the first thing he said was, lose the just.
Our thanks to Maggie Farrar and Alan Lee. Now, to someone who is a writer, consultant, podcaster, and former vice president of Twitter, Bruce Daisley reflects on his presentation and why the concept of resilience first caught his attention.
Well, firstly, I think we're just surrounded with the word resilience. The talk prior to mine today featured resilience pretty heavily. And I think, you know, we're surrounded in a world, whether it's the classroom or the staff room, where we're just interested in trying to make sure people are more resilient. My own personal interest is that my partner's Lebanese, and we were in Beirut when there was this almighty explosion 3 years ago, and all the news coverage said, all the Lebanese people are resilient, they'll handle it. And it's just this interesting thing where as soon as you recognise that we use resilience in a slightly tainted way, as soon as you recognise that, you see it everywhere. And, you know, I guess at the very worst, resilience has got a degree of victim blaming to it, because you're expecting people to have the ability to they've been knocked down, but you're going to get back up, aren't you? And it sort of, in its worst, diminishes the experience of people. So I think I wanted to come at it with a fresh set of eyes, really.
Do you think the education system is just so far had a very one-dimensional view of what it is to be resilient?
Look, I think the very nature of everywhere is that we're all looking, if not explicitly for quick fixes, but we're looking for quick solutions to things. And you know, look, I'll give you the context. Resilience is one of the most heavily implemented initiatives around the world, and the great thing about that is it gives you lots of data. The US military has spent $500 million training all its combat soldiers to be resilient, and similarly the same programs have been used across US schools. And the great thing about that is that when you've had that amount of people, a million combat soldiers alone, and then all these people go through it, the great thing is other researchers say, let's go and measure how they got on. And the fascinating thing about that, as I talked about today, is that all of the research says those resilience programs have zero impact. Not just a little bit, not as good as we know, they have zero impact. And I think what that forces you to do, in my perspective, is reevaluate. Are we looking for resilience in the wrong place? My perspective is always that, you know, if you look in the wild, you see resilience everywhere. People in Ukraine, resilient. People who survive natural disasters, resilient. You know, people who feature on the evening news and they're dealing with some tragedy and they're just demonstrating this incredible strength. So resilience definitely exists in the world, but we struggle to create it. We struggle to create a resilience program that has a measurable difference. And I think it's because resilience isn't this individual thing that some of us have got, some of us haven't got, some of us have trained into us. Resilience is a collective strength. Resilience is the strength we draw from each other. And as soon as you recognise that, all of the people that you've probably observed who have been resilient probably have got something in common that characterises it.
The backdrop in education to such a large and overwhelming degree is to test, to assess, to measure. Is ironically that helpful in what you are championing here today at the conference?
Yeah, there's an old adage which is called Goodhart's Law, which is any measure that any measure which becomes a target ceases to be a good measure. And, you know, I think we can often find ourselves thinking, oh, good, that's a good indication. So all of a sudden you set it as a target and people's priorities get shifted, so it no longer is as helpful as it was before. So I think, you know, Goodhart's Law probably gives us a good perspective on that, that sometimes measuring things and setting objectives up for them don't necessarily always achieve the goal we want.
I'd just like to explore one of your other books is The Joy of Work. The teaching profession arguably has felt very little of that recently. Ofsted pay, the recruitment crisis, retention crisis, etc. What do you think are the other ways that we can restore some of the joy?
Yeah, I think, you know, more than anything else, there's a wonderful piece of work done by an American researcher, and, you know, a woman called Teresa Marble, and she asked a very simple question. She built this enormous diary survey, and she asked people, what does a good day at work look like? And, you know, people had to write down. A good day at work is when people felt like they'd made progress in something and they felt respected for making that progress. And I think, you know, they're vital components. To feel like we've done something of consequence and we've earned the respect of others, you know, like we actually people have been grateful for that work, I think is probably at the heart of all of that challenge. You know, all anyone really wants to do is, everyone wants to do a good job and they want to feel like they're given the freedom to do that job. So I think, you know, that's probably all of the challenges that we've got. Sometimes people feel there's a lack of respect or there's a lack of ability to get progress, to get the job done.
By definition, the notion of teachers in schools doesn't naturally lend itself to a rounded sense of remote working, because we have to have the classroom scenario, the classroom environment. But we are seeing pushback by some CEOs, other organisational heads. You know, look, come on, guys, we need to be back in the office. I want to see more people in the office. You know, how are you feeling about that message? Is that going to be a counterproductive message? Will that help teachers and leaders or not?
I think, you know, we've gone through various stages of thinking about flexible working, and I think most teachers pretty quickly worked out remote teaching doesn't seem to have the same impact as in-person teaching, and you know, so as a result, over time, we're all learning that some things that aren't easy to substitute, some things that we can gloriously substitute, there's a lot that we can't. You know, we're witnessing this in the wider world of work, that more and more organisations are setting up training for their employees, which are 10 hours of digital training, and people sit in a sort of catatonic state, clicking through this classroom that's meant to be teaching them. And the end result, if people are candid about it, is that people have sat there bored, pretending to pay attention. And so, you know, I think the more honest we are about what are the honest outputs of what we're doing, the better, really. But, you know, the one thing we've undoubtedly learned over the course of the last 3 years is the value of the elite value of educators, people who can actually take a thought and put it in someone else's head, cannot be undervalued.
I was particularly drawn to, fascinated by something in your session, which obviously plays a pivotal role, and that's the connectedness idea. We were talking before we started recording about a book on school transition, you know, how pupils make that move from primary to secondary. And that particular book talks a lot about belongingness. I mean, as you see resilience as needing to be a collective thing, I guess a sense of belonging with students needs to kind of dovetail into that and segue into that.
Yeah, probably the biggest finding of social science over the last 10 years, and it's something that was gradually known, but it's only really gained respect, is the notion that feeling connected to other people and belonging is a synonym for that, has an impact. And probably the biggest piece of work that's been done on it, there was a bit of work by a woman called Julianne Holt Lundstedt, and she equated it to loneliness is the equivalent of smoking 15 cigarettes a day. But that's not suggesting that loneliness is a rare thing. Loneliness is an incredibly prevalent thing. And the sort of strange paradox about loneliness is that you can be loneliness and surrounded by people. So, you know, you can be in a lonely marriage. You can be in a lonely household. And it's actually recognising that these things are really important. And, you know, one of the things I talked about today is these there's a little adage that one social scientist said, looking at people who are retired, but he said, if you're not a member of a group and you join a group, you halve your chance of dying next year. So, you know, I think about that all the time with, you know, the retired people in my life. I think, okay, well, how do I ensure that they have connections in their and social life, and what can I do to facilitate that? Because if it's such a big part of our well-being, in a way that any of us would scratch our head, and you know, you can understand someone doing more exercise is good, you can understand someone having a healthier diet is good, you can understand someone giving up smoking or not drinking is good, but if I told you more important than any of those is being strongly socially connected, it's a sort of, it's a baffling power of that intervention. I think understanding that is just a really important part of understanding. So to your point about belongingness, absolutely, anything we can do to cultivate that is really helpful.
But do you think it's possible for people to take concepts, ideas like fortitude, like resilience, and get to a point where they think, do you know what? I think I have sufficient fortitude. Is there any way you can know that?
Gosh, that's, I mean, you know, I guess we only know if we're tested by adversity. Generally we see charming stories of it, and you know, sport is always a bad place, but you know, normally the team that triumphs and finds itself on the podium at the end of a season is the team that is more connected to each other and seem to have a stronger rapport. It's very rare that you see a group of people who don't like each other celebrating on stage. So I'm not sure we could ever have too much, but I think for me, the revelation of seeing resilience as the strength we draw from each other is the thing that's actually been a really sort of teachable moment for me myself. Very easy to make adaptations of your own life based on that.
And I assume you'd like to see that across the board in schools. Do you think that's a message that the DfE, the government, Ofsted, etc., have to pick up on and act on?
It's really interesting. One of the world's leading experts on teenage mental well-being is a woman called Jean Twenge, and she studies teenagers, and one of the things I said in my presentation is that she characterises teenagers as having gone from being Generation We, surrounded with friends, these sort of gregarious social groups, to Generation Me. Not necessarily reporting that they don't have friends, but their relationships are sort of mediated through screens. But one of the things that's a really interesting difference, TeacherTap have data about British schools, and they say that 80% of British secondary schools do not allow phones out during the school day. Now that is a big difference to American schools. American schools, you're allowed phones out, phones are often sort of part, and it's really interesting, you can benchmark the mental health of those two different groups. So albeit teenagers are struggling everywhere around the world, and you know, probably so mobile phones do play a part in that, but where the use of phones is mediated somewhat, it seems to have an impact. So the British approach of not allowing phones in schools seems to be where America's heading towards.
And we've come to the end of this special episode from Birmingham. Our thanks to Blackberry Productions, the ICC, Maggie Farrar, Alan Lee, James Bowen, Bruce Daisley, and all of the brilliant staff at the NEHT Hub. We'll see you next year. In the meantime, do keep an eye across the official website for the conference. It's inspiringleadership.org. Take care.
Leadership that's inspired. Conversations that leave a mark. Leave a mark. Leave a mark.